Frank Lloyd Wright, the celebrated architect, had a lot of opinions about art, and he offered them at the drop of a hat. He might have been the most verbal architect ever.
What have you been reading, or what music have you been listening to? What paintings do you look at?
All of them that are available, good and bad, because they're all features of architecture. They're all the arts are subject to the mother art, which is architecture.
He'd been known to refer to these other arts, such as painting and sculpture, as minor arts, with the possible exception of music, which he thought of as equal to architecture, he said, in a 1956 interview at the Plaza Hotel.
My father taught me that a symphony was an edifice of sound, and that it was built. And I learned pretty soon that it was built by the same kind of mind in much the same way that a building is built. And when that came to me, I used to sit and listen to the only master that was immaculate in my listening was Beethoven. He was a great architect.
That was Wright, a man of great proclamations, a man who spoke convincingly about art and the natural world, and yet there he was striding about in a cape and that hat he always wore and spoke at the drop of. The prolific Mr. Wright was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin in 1867, and is said to have transformed residential design in the United States, having worked in a style known as the Prairie School, with very horizontal houses that communed with the flat landscapes of the Midwest. And millions have traveled great distances to see Falling Water, the southwestern Pennsylvania house Wright designed for Edgar Kaufman and his family in the late 30s. Wright had many thoughts about urban landscapes, too.
Skyscrapers in cities increase congestion, and they've proved to be the death of the city, or will, eventually.
This is from the program Omnibus with Alistair Cook.
Don't approve of New York.
Well, I don't think you approve of New York. Does anyone approve of New York?
This is meat and drink, you know, to our viewers in the California and
isn't New York just a great, overgrown village crazed by success?
He appeared to think New York City had a grim future.
And now the whole city is in agony. But this traffic problem is insoluble. It never can be solved, and you see everything going out, decentralization.
So it's interesting to note how much Wright's design for the Guggenheim Museum and New York City did for each other.
Wright was an old man. He'd never built a museum. He was looking for a legacy.
Mosette Broderick lectures at NYU in architecture and urban planning.
And this could really be it. He never did one public building of that nature.
And in 1943, when the distinguished maverick Mr. Wright was first approached by the Guggenheim team, New York was still reeling from the very bad times that had begun with the stock market crash.
In 1929, everything stopped. A couple of buildings kept going, but in general, everything stopped. No one did any maintenance. Buildings' windows became jittery. Everything began to look very seedy and very sad. In the 1930s, very little other than post offices and Rockefeller Center were built.
The Empire State Building, I should add, was finished in 1931. But in the next decades, there were other problems.
During the 1940s, after the war, what was going to happen? Was New York City going to atrophy? Was everybody going to go somewhere else? There were no homes for the soldiers coming back.
And where was the center of the city going to be?
Is New York City going to, if it emerges again, is it going to emerge at Wall Street? Or is it going to go to Midtown, which had just started when the crash came? So what was going to happen?
The jumpstart that was needed, according to Ms. Broderick, did come. Everyone was excited about a new museum. Wright, famously obsessed with automobiles, could be seen riding around town in an open-top Cadillac, looking for the perfect site for the museum. And the notion of a circular building, navigated by a continuous ramp from bottom to top, was a known solution to the parking garage, if not necessarily a perfect one for looking at art. Though Wright, who considered himself a natural and organic architect, long before those words were to appear on every food package and clothing item, said his design was a curving wave that never breaks. In any case, it finally started construction in the mid-1950s with a contractor who was, no surprise, an experienced garage builder. But of course, the matter of how it works as a museum is still an issue, and it was a question from the start. John Kanaday, then the art critic of the New York Times, wrote a critique headlined Right versus Painting. If he had deliberately designed an interior to annihilate painting as an expressive art and to reduce it to an architectural accessory, wrote Kanaday, he could not have done much better. And the New Yorker cartoonists had a field day with images of perplexed patrons standing on a slant. Lewis Mumford, writing for that magazine, said, "You may go to this building to see Kandinsky or Jackson Pollock. You remain to see Frank Lloyd Wright." But what many at the time may not have realized, Mazette Broderick says, was that this museum was among a handful of buildings to have made the difference in post-World War II Manhattan.
I think the lifeblood of New York in the 40s, just after the war, was the possibility of a cultural beacon, the New Guggenheim, and a world beacon, the United Nations. They were the two buildings that were bringing hope. Well, maybe New York will be all right after all. Maybe people will come back.
And there was another building from 1952 that made its mark, Lever House, the second so-called curtain wall skyscraper after the UN building, that played a role in bringing New York back from what looked like oblivion for a while. So the Guggenheim was more than an art museum, much more. And Wright, age 91, knew it.
I think he must have taken every vitamin known to mankind to stay alive for the decade that it was being built. He didn't succeed. He died 6 months before the building opened.
All these years later, there it sits, a remarkable, imperfect place. New York would be nothing without its magnificent, tradition-defying, one-of-a-kind compromises. It's Fishko Files. I'm Sarah Fishko.